Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I am your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so that's what we look at. I share ideas and strategies. I tell stories. I share my mistakes with the hope that we can all help students reach that creative potential. So this is my third in a series called Vintage Innovation. And I want to build on something from last week. Last week, I talked about the Astrodome effect, which is just this full force, go at it, try to aim for futurism, and why that often doesn't work. I talked about why we need to embrace both vintage tools and vintage designs in a mashup with newer technology and newer ideas. And I talked about how the ballpark of Camden Yards was a sharp contrast to that. And so today I want to talk about these barriers, though, because we all feel them, we all experience them. I did when I taught middle school. I sometimes feel this at the higher education level. You know, what are the big barriers that prevent teachers from doing things like PBL and design thinking and other innovative teaching practices? And I mention this because I've had the honor of leading PBL and design thinking workshops all over the world. Early on in each workshop, I ask participants to identify the challenges that they face when trying to implement innovative teaching strategies. And whether it's Australia or the Netherlands or Hong Kong or the US, certain challenges always emerge. I see this all the time. We don't have enough time, we don't have the best technology, and we're stuck with a tight curriculum map. And often that's connected to fear about students doing poorly on the test. And these same challenges are the challenges I faced as a middle school teacher in a low-income school in Phoenix, Arizona. And they're the same challenges my teacher candidates here in Oregon experience in their practicums. Whether it's a rural school or a suburban school or an urban school, it doesn't seem to matter. We all feel this. If we think about it this way, innovation is scary. It involves stepping into the unknown and taking a risk. So we need to be cognizant of these barriers. If you're a leader, it helps to give teachers the permission to make mistakes and to innovate and experiment and fail forward. And if I'm going to be honest, I had the best teaching years. I was the most innovative myself. I took the most creative risks when I had some phenomenal principals who encouraged it and who allowed it and who said it's okay if mistakes happen. By contrast, I always pulled back and I didn't take as many risks when I was in an environment that was high stakes and accountability driven. I also want to point out that we need to be honest about the injustices that lead to things like less time and inadequate resources and restrictive curriculum maps. Innovation requires us to transform these systems, and we have to be honest about the injustice that exists. But innovation also means viewing these challenges as problems to be solved and working within the system to do innovative things. So let's take a deep dive into these three main problems and focus on how we solve it. So problem number one, there is no time. When we think about things like design thinking and project-based learning and inquiry-based learning, it can feel daunting to pull off a project within the tight time constraints of the school day. Things often feel rushed. We have so many standards to cover in such a small amount of time. But innovation isn't about adding something to your plate. It's about rearranging your plate with a focus on voice and choice. There are several strategies that we can use to make time for innovative projects. First, we can reduce teacher talk by limiting direct instruction and reducing the time spent giving directions. This was the hardest thing for me as an eighth grade teacher. Direct instruction can feel efficient, but the reality is it's often less efficient. Kids can often learn more and retain more by discovering things on their own. And if you imagine it, it's like, well, you're doing direct instruction, you're talking, they're listening, they're taking notes, that's it. But with things like PBL or design thinking, students spend more time doing the work themselves. they ask more questions, they find the answers on their own. And sometimes I'm a guide helping them out. Sometimes I'm a curator sharing specific targeted resources. But the goal is for me to talk less and students to work more. And as they dig deeper as a result, they actually retain more. Now, this might not feel as efficient. Students often learn at a deeper level, though, and they retain more information for a longer period of time when they wrestle with it. It might not look as efficient, but we actually save time by having students maximize their work time within a class period. In addition, it helps to have fewer tasks and fewer transitions, so students develop that habit of deep work. And it can help to have structures for projects. For example, the launch structure builds in mutual accountability and interdependency into projects. There's things like the 20-minute peer feedback system. You can find it on my website, which allows for assessment in the moment rather than wasting time taking an assessment. I remember wasting entire class periods taking tests when I knew if students understood the concepts or not. The reality is that formative assessment I'd been doing gave me all the information I needed. I didn't need something summative. So what I'm saying is that sometimes the best way to save time is to do assessment in the moment in a way where you are assessing by doing or assessing while you go rather than taking an assessment. I will say this, you will always, within projects and within design thinking, have to have direct instruction. But the idea is to minimize it and to make it as valuable as possible for students so they have more work time. And that's just one of the ways to do it. It also helps to combine standards and to cover multiple standards in the same day. And we'll get to that when we talk about problem number three. But let's move to problem number two. I don't have enough technology. Now, last week, I talked about the value of going low tech. Often it can be more hands-on and more developmentally appropriate. And there are low tech solutions that can be simpler and less time consuming. Often a low-tech approach pushes divergent thinking and creativity because you're forced to work within these constraints to solve problems. So what I'm saying is that sometimes low-tech actually works better. Now, this doesn't mean that we have to reject high-tech solutions. It's just that technology isn't always necessary to do innovative projects in our classrooms. It's a reminder that innovation is about better thinking and not better technology. In fact, some of the best maker spaces I've seen blend together the low tech and high tech in creative ways. They might, for example, have students on a computer, two students per computer to facilitate collaborative coding. I've seen that and it works amazingly well. Or I love, if you ever check out Jackie Gerstein's work on maker spaces, she often talks about having kids do things like circuitry and coding along with duct tape and cardboard and Legos and things like that. And to me, that's the idea of a vintage innovation makerspace. Another example that I would say is Sam Patterson, who blends together high-tech gadgetry with things like sewing and puppetry and I guess things that you would call more, you know, hands-on, lo-fi, and old school. And again, those would be the idea of that vintage innovation makerspace. And so what I'm saying is we don't always have to have the fancy 3D printers. We don't always have to have the brand new iMacs. Yes, those things are valuable, but the reality is actually limiting our technology and choosing to take a more blended approach might just lead to better innovation. All right, problem number three. I have to follow a tight curriculum map. Now, we often experience this. If you teach in a public school, you sometimes feel it intensely. I remember losing, 6 weeks a year to standardized testing and just feeling like, man, I have a tight curriculum map and I don't have enough time. The traditional approach to teaching focuses on isolating specific skills and teaching them systematically to students. But with PBL and design thinking, we have students learn a concept while they practice a skill. They work on multiple interconnected standards at the same time instead of going sequentially through each standard. So if you're going to visualize it, instead of having an arrow going down from each standard one by one by one by one, what you have is more like an interconnected web where standards are going back and forth between each other and kids are kind of ping-ponging back and forth in this way that is fully integrated. And that actually saves a lot of time, and it allows you some freedom within the curriculum to do things like PBL. In some cases, you might go fully competency-based and allow students to skip standards they've already mastered. That's another way, again, to both save time and to fit within the curriculum map. For example, in the research phase of a project, students can work on specific reading skills that they need to master and skip the skills they've already mastered. So if they're researching something within a project or design thinking activity, what they can actually be doing is practicing the standards that they need to still master. They might need to work on drawing conclusions or compare and contrast, and they're practicing those skills as they go. Another way to do it is a mini project with a choice grid, and I have a link to it on this particular podcast notes and the show notes on the website. You can look at the article. I have a choice grid that I found to be really helpful for students, and they can self-select the skills and the standards. The idea, though, is this, that a project shouldn't be something you do at the end of the unit. Again, it's not something you add later. It's not something you add to your plate. Instead, students should discover the content as the project progresses. Note that sometimes you will still need to do direct instruction. That's okay. And you might even need to begin your project with a quick concept attainment lesson. And that's okay. But the idea is to integrate things like direct instruction and concept attainment in a way that feels authentic and allows for students to master multiple standards at the same time. Now, I admit that this can be really challenging if the curriculum is super rigid. Sometimes you have scripted curriculum you are required to follow, and sometimes you have specific standards that you have to teach each day, but it helps to think about where the wiggle room might be. For example, you might have scripted curriculum in reading and math, but you have more leeway in science or social studies. Or the prescribed curriculum might simply be a resource. In these moments, you might be able to ask your leadership if you could pilot a mini project. This works really well in those lame duck days when other teachers might be showing movies before the break. One of my big aha moments was that I had to cover certain standards each week, but no one explicitly prevented me from reviewing or previewing other standards. So this is how I was able to group them together. In other words, let's say we were doing volume and proportional reasoning and surface area. These are all different standards, but I can blend them into a project, which I'll get to in just a bit. And so even though I'm covering the standards each week, I'm still reviewing or previewing the other standards at the same time. Similarly, when it came to language arts, I had all of these standards that were topic neutral, right? So they were reading and writing standards based on the Common Core. If you're in America, you know we have the Common Core standards, and they don't tell you what topics to cover. You have a lot of leeway on what topics you have to cover. So I could do, say, a research project where students did blogging and created podcasts, and they were hitting the language arts standards in both reading and listening while also hitting the standards in writing for informational text and persuasive text. Not so much in narrative, but that was okay. Through a two-week project, we actually hammered like probably two-thirds of our ELA standards. Now that's efficient. That saves time and that is authentic, right? Now, what was I supposed to cover during those weeks? I was supposed to cover some key standards in informational text, but by saying we're all gonna do this standards and we're gonna have these other connecting standards that I want you to practice along the way, I was able to present this as we're covering these standards, but we're also reviewing and previewing these other standards. So that's how that worked. Now, to me, this all comes down to the food truck mindset. Now, I know this sounds odd, but just bear with me. This is the idea of the food truck mindset. When we think of innovative companies, it's easy to imagine an open-air tech startup with table tennis courts. Well, I guess it's not a court. Table tennis tables? And free drinks and huge windows and chairs so modern you're not sure if you're supposed to sit in them or look at them. And sometimes I look at these spaces and I think, man, I wish schools could be more like that. But they're not. We don't have a ton of startup capital making these spaces perfect. And while these companies often look amazing, there's many startups that go bankrupt within the first 3 years. The reality is schools are nothing like startups. Meanwhile, some of the most innovative ideas are happening in smaller and much more humble environments, greasy, tiny kitchens parked by the side of busy streets. If you want to find innovation, look no further than your local food truck. Food trucks continue to redefine the way we view food through a fusion of flavors that are unabashedly different than the typical restaurant fare. Unlike the massive tech startup world, food trucks are nimble. They're small, and they're focused on a very distinct mission. They often borrow ideas from unrelated places and use ingredients that you wouldn't expect to use. They connect to their community, and they use local ingredients in ways that absolutely tie into their neighborhoods. I created a little sketch video on this concept. I love the idea of the food truck mindset. You can check it out at spencervideos.com. But I mention this because I had this coworker and friend named Javi, and he was the embodiment of a food truck mindset. When he was stuck with a four-hour block, this rigid ELL block and a tight curriculum, he basically said, "Let's do it, man. Like, why can't ELL students in a Title I school have the same projects as gifted students?" When he and our tech director, Chad, had to create a summer school for struggling students, they redesigned the entire idea of summer school. They fit within the limitations they had. The kids who didn't want to be there, doing review work they didn't want to do, learning the same way that they always had to learn. And instead, they worked within that constraint to design this amazing summer STEAM camp. And it was so popular that they had a waiting list of kids who were all failing and wanted to get into it. To me, that's food trucking it, and that is amazing. When Javi and I wanted computers in our classroom, we refurbished old computers that were virtually useless, and we ran them on Linux. That's food trucking it. I remember feeling frustrated by having to teach a full hour of grammar to my ELL students. I mean, grammar, what do you do with that? Teaching grammar? When I said grammar can't be fun, Javi laughed and said, "Why not?" So I turned the constraint into a design feature, and our grammar lessons became a vehicle for student blogging and podcasting projects. These were my vintage innovation lessons, combining old tools with new technology and embracing old ideas like curation and citizen journalism with newer research-based strategies. Again, I was food trucking it. I still remember this time when my tech director, Chad, that I mentioned already, came into my classroom. And he noticed a student walk up to me and say, "Mr. Spencer, are we going to do grammar today?" And when I said, "No, not today, but we'll make up for that time tomorrow," this girl began arguing with me. And Chad's mouth dropped. "Are you serious? She's that excited about grammar?" he asked. Yeah. For this girl, grammar was fun. Now, to me, that is what it's all about. It's this idea of taking the limitation, taking the challenge, taking the things that you think aren't going to work and flipping it upside down and saying, "This will be our design feature." Similarly, when students struggled through volume, I say suffered because they suffered through some really bad lessons that I taught, very traditional lessons that I taught on volume and surface area and proportional reasoning, and it wasn't working. So I used the standards that we had to teach, the time constraint of a few weeks, and these became the building blocks of our tiny house project. Again, we used some digital tools for research and 3D modeling, but they created their houses with duct tape and cardboard. I used the food truck mindset from Javi to embrace this idea of vintage innovation. When we choose to design meaningful projects despite the tight curriculum maps and limited time frame and lack of adequate technology, we are modeling divergent thinking for our students. We are modeling that food truck mindset. And we are able to embrace the idea of vintage innovation. I think it helps to ask questions like, what is the loose and the tight in this? What are the constraints or limitations? And which of these might actually become a design feature? Which standards can we combine or layer? Are there any lo-fi materials that might actually improve the project? And the more we begin asking these questions, the more we shift away from asking why to asking why not, and the more likely we are to innovate within our own practice. I want to end by just saying this. I believe that every teacher is an innovator. And I'm not saying this to tell you how to be innovative. I don't know the answer to that. The reality is you are already doing amazing, innovative things. But I mention all of this because one of the things I really believe is despite the challenges and the barriers and the problems we face, we can get past the time and curriculum map and lack of technology and still do innovative things in our classroom. And so I want to end by saying thank you for the amazing work that you're already doing. I keep hearing stories. People email me stories. They tweet me stories. I get to meet people in person. And I am blown away with what teachers do on a regular basis when faced with some of these challenges and limitations. So I just want to say thank you for doing what you do. Hey, if you enjoy this podcast, would you do me a favor? Would you leave a review on iTunes, or I guess it's now Apple Podcasts and Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts? That would mean the world to me. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.